Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to our workshop today. And today's program is for caregivers coping with a loved one's metastatic prostate cancer. And this is part of our two-part Living with Metastatic Prostate Cancer series. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, as well as prostate cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, there are 611 of you on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the country, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Ireland, Tunisia, Ukraine, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today's program was made possible by an educational grant provided by Janssen Biotech, Inc., and an educational donation provided by Amgen. I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series and today's program, of course, and also for their collaborative partnership in making this program possible. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is information about our speakers, and there's information about the topics they'll be addressing, as well as the collaborating organizations. And there also is an evaluation form. And I'd like to have you take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs and topics you'd like us to offer? You are the best people, really, to tell us the things that you need us to do. And so we very much value your feedback, and we try very hard also to implement what you suggest. We are planning a lot of programs for the coming year, and look forward to your feedback for this program. And indeed, this particular series was one that was really generated because of many of your requests that we offer this program. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. And Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. Dr. Slovin is also the recipient of the Cancer Care Physician of the Year Award, and she also has been a frequent presenter on our workshops on prostate cancer and other topics as well. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and hello to my public, as I like to often say. Hope everybody is well. It's going to be very hard to give you every little nuance of prostate cancer this afternoon, but what I'm hoping to do is just hit a few high points. And, of course, there will be a question and answer session after all the speakers, and please feel free to address any questions or concerns you have, because I think this will make it perhaps a lot easier for you to go back to your personal physicians and perhaps discuss your concerns. I think it's extremely important to know what we mean by metastatic disease. First is that when patients are newly diagnosed, for the most part, many people have disease that's confined to the prostate. What we term as being metastatic means that the disease itself is beyond the area of the prostate itself. It may involve seminal vesicles, lymph nodes, or even further out, which is bone. Another interpretation of metastatic disease occurs when someone has already had primary treatment for their cancers, meaning surgery or radiation, and has, as the only manifestation of the disease returning, a rise in PSA. Now, why is that metastatic? Because you don't see anything on the bone scan or CAT scan. The fact that a PSA returns is known as a biochemical relapse, meaning that the disease is still active, but it still means that there's probably microscopic cells floating around in the circulation that have not more or less decided on a place to live and grow, and therefore we can't see them on scans. Another definition of metastatic disease occurs after someone who has been treated with hormonal therapy and has progression of their disease, again, is manifested by a PSA that is no longer at zero, and has disease that has progressed on bone scan or CAT scan. This is what we call castrate metastatic because patients have been on hormonal therapy. They have levels of testosterone to indicate that they no longer are masculine, if you will, meaning that they've been castrated, but their cancer still progresses. I'd like to focus on one new approach for patients who are newly diagnosed and have metastatic disease. I will, however, discuss patients who have already had hormonal therapy and have progressive disease very shortly. But one of the new things that has just come to everybody's attention is a result of the phase 3 randomized clinical trial, meaning this was a clinical trial of close to 800 or 900 men, where we try to address a question as to whether or not men who present with metastatic disease to bone at the time of diagnosis and who would normally would be treated with hormonal therapy that would bring their PSAs down to zero and hopefully put their disease into remission, would benefit even more by the addition of chemotherapy. Now, the standard chemotherapy that we've been using for prostate cancer for years has been docetaxel, otherwise known as Taxotere. Now, in this randomized study, meaning patients at the flip of the coin either received just standard hormonal therapy or standard hormonal therapy with docetaxel will be given to them every 3 weeks. And what the interesting results led to was the fact that patients, and this was completely unexpected, who went on the combination of chemotherapy with docetaxel and hormonal therapy in the setting of metastatic disease actually had significant benefit at multiple levels compared with those who were on just the plain androgen deprivation. And the benefit was noted through the course of actually several years. The other interesting fact about this is that when they went back, they were able to break down the groups into the following: those patients who presented with 4 or greater metastatic lesions in bone versus those who had less. And interestingly, those who had greater than 4, which could be 4, 10, 40, et cetera, actually had a much, much greater benefit than those who had less than 4. Now, when I say less than 4, a lot of discussion about whether or not you should be on this kind of approach is really going to be very heavily dependent on what your physician sees on your scans. So there can be patients who have 4 little bone lesions that are so tiny that as to be really very unimpressive. And then there are those who have 4 lesions that are huge lesions, each of which is taking up a large surface area in the bone. Or perhaps one very large coalescent lesion where several smaller lesions had previously been. Those are the people that we're talking about. Now, while this is not true that it's beneficial for every patient who has metastatic disease that's 4 or greater in terms of lesion number, nevertheless, it is appropriate for some people, and this is why your doctor will need to make the decision as to what would be beneficial for you. For those patients who have metastatic disease that have progressed despite hormonal therapy, we still have a huge armamentarium of treatments. And I'd like to point out one very important thing, and that is one size does not fit all. Very often we hear from patients, well, how come I didn't get this one or that treatment and my friend got the other one? Your disease is unique to you. Yes, we have demographics that looks at the similarity of cancers, the behavior of cancers as a group, but the reality is that what we try to do is personalize your treatment and understanding the fact that if you put 5 men in the room, each with the same cancer, some patients will do very well and some patients may have a much harder time and become more symptomatic. So the standard of care, as you know, for metastatic disease is hormonal therapy, and more recently we have found that those patients who have failed have a wonderful armamentarium of new treatments, all of which have significant benefits. The first has been for patients who have had asymptomatic or minimally symptomatic disease. This is the first immunotherapy that was ever approved in prostate cancer, known as Provenge, or Cipolucel T. And this is a cellular product immunotherapy where your own cells are removed. They are processed in a laboratory, sensitized against a molecule that's on your prostate cancer, and returned to you within a 48-hour period. Each infusion, this is a total of 3, is given every 2 weeks, and this also was found to have a benefit. Now, interestingly, while this still remains an active therapeutic opportunity for a lot of patients, there are some patients for whom a perhaps more rapid approach might be needed. The problem with immunotherapy, and this is not just unique to Provenge, is that we are very unsure as to how long it takes for an anti-tumor effect to occur. So in some cases, patients who might be more symptomatic or whose PSAs are doubling or tripling very quickly may benefit from some of the newer androgen receptor-directed therapies. The first is enzalutamide, which was FDA approved following patients receiving docetaxel. However, based on new data, this drug will now be given in the pre-chemotherapy arena. Similarly, abiraterone, which is a different class of drugs, enzalutamide, just to keep in mind, is similar to a very high potency bicalutamide or Casodex, whereas abiraterone works in a particular metabolic pathway within the adrenal gland. Enzalutamide and abiraterone both were approved initially to be given following chemotherapy and are still strongly recommended if chemotherapy doesn't work. However, based on some very new data, both of these drugs will now be, or abiraterone at least to date, has been moved to the pre-chemotherapy, and based on a recent phase 3 trial, so will enzalutamide. In fact, the approval is at the FDA right now. Docetaxel still remains the chemotherapy, which is the first standard of care. Now, some people think that giving chemo is just the first thing that we do. We don't. My indications for using chemo is somebody who has a rapid PSA doubling time of less than 3 months, or is symptomatic, meaning they feel weak, they can't eat, they're not thriving, or if they have such significant pain that I would have to radiate multiple sites of disease and perhaps compromise their bone marrow, chemotherapy will improve quality of life and sometimes help with pain, and therefore I prefer to use it under those circumstances. We also have, if, for example, one has failed docetaxel or enzalutamide or abiraterone, cabazitaxel, the other name for that is Gemtana. This was the first chemotherapy drug that was approved in the setting of patients who have failed primary therapy with docetaxel. Another opportunity that may be reasonable for some people, even before they go on to chemo, if they have terrible pain, for example, and Dr. Kubert will shortly be talking about pain control, will be radium-223. Many of you may remember Marie Curie from the turn of the century, the 1900s, who discovered radium. Well, this is a drug, and it's been shown in European trials to not only improve pain control, but also have additional benefits. And this can be used as a monthly injection for 6 months, and it has been shown to have important endpoints that improve patients' quality of life. Now, while I mentioned before, one size is not necessarily fit all. I think patients are often under the impression that we have a checklist, and if you fail A, you go to B, and if you fail B, you go to C, and that's not the case. Coming from an academic center, we try to be a lot more creative and perhaps forestall the need to do treatments that may impact on someone's quality of life, albeit even transiently, and therefore the importance of clinical trials cannot be understated. Clinical trials afford patients the opportunity to use drugs that have perhaps been around for a very long time but have been repurposed or given on unique schedules or with unique combinations. And the benefit of clinical trials is that sometimes new drugs or drugs, again, that have been around and being used in a different manner actually end up being extremely, extremely helpful to the patient. So there is an advantage. And not every clinical trial has a placebo, which worries patients. Sometimes it's against a standard drug that's out there. Another aspect that I'd like to bring to everybody's attention is personalized medicine. There's quite a number of opportunities on the internet for patients to send their tissue or blood to agencies to get quote-unquote personalized genomic information. What are the genes that are involved and what treatments might they respond to? And quite frankly, this is not validated. In fact, we at various academic centers still don't know which genes that are being reported as being deleted or overexpressed or whatever are important. What are actionable, meaning which ones do we really take into consideration for treatment? And while helpful from a research standpoint, they are still not standards of care. In closing, one other thing is extremely important, and I do not cannot tell you how important it is, and that's for the caregiver. I meet a lot of spouses, I meet a lot of partners and family members who accompany patients, and I want to have everybody understand that we as medical oncologists or physicians in taking care of patients with cancer do understand that there's a great deal of pressure in the home environment. There is significant pressure on the spouse or partner or child in taking care of the patient. The spouses themselves often feel alone, and there are programs that have the advantage of providing couples or spousal therapy, therapy that will support the caretaker, because the caretakers feel that they have to be on call 24 hours a day. And while we appreciate all their efforts, they need to have their own moments where they can just decompress. And that's why most doctors and their organizations and their ancillary staff are there to try to make it easy for the spouse. The only time that I get a little bit concerned is when children, and we're talking adult children, have no knowledge that the father has prostate cancer. And believe it or not, in this day and age, I call it the savior syndrome, where after a patient has prostate cancer for 15 or 20 years, the son or the daughter suddenly wants to save dad. They had no knowledge that the father had prostate cancer, and they want to come in there and help in the best way possible. The problem is their understanding of the scenario. The fact that they've not been involved makes it very difficult. They come in often very angry, particularly at the medical oncologist, who may have had a relationship with the patient and his spouse or partner for 15 or 20 years. And yet these children or relatives come in with different expectations. I can only encourage our listeners that if you do have children, adult children, please make them aware, or at least bring them into the doctor's office once so that they can understand who the doctor is, establish a rapport, and feel that they can be told what's going on. Because being surprised after 15 or 20 years when a family member starts to decline is very frightening for them. And sometimes their hostilities are taken out on the poor oncologists who are trying their best to keep everybody afloat. So I'm just going to stop here. I will be available for questions, and I turn this back to you, Carolyn. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Slovin, for, as always, an outstanding presentation and exceptionally well presented and lots of information as well. And our next speaker is William Gorin, Bill Gorin, and he's Director of Clinical Services at Cancer Care. And Mr. Gorin is going to present on who is a caregiver, the stresses of family, partners, friends, and loved ones, coping with holidays, birthdays, and special occasions, long-distance caregiving, and self-care and stress management tips. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Mr. Gorin.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. At Cancer Care, we do acknowledge that cancer is a family disease, and I would say that with prostate cancer could also be considered a couple's disease for those who are in marriages or other committed relationships. Caregiving is a complex labor of love and responsibility directly affecting life, love, daily life of the relationship, the present and the future. But without question, cancer creates stressors, and as Dr. Slovin rightly said, creates pressures, pressures on the individual with cancer, pressure on the caregiver, pressure on the family, adult children, and smaller children. So there is stress for the person with cancer, there is stress for the caregiver, and then there is relationship or couple stress. The stress can be at equal levels, just as high for the person with cancer as it is for the stressors. They're just different types of stress. The challenge then becomes not only how do I cope and adjust to my cancer diagnosis or for a caregiver, how do I cope with my partner's disease, but just as importantly, how do we as a couple cope with the new stressors caused by prostate cancer? This becomes especially significant for those couples and for those caregivers living with loved one with metastatic prostate cancer. For most caregivers, providing variable types of care, whether it is informal, whether it's part-time assistance to more timely, emotional, hands-on, medical and activities of daily life, whether it's in person or long distance, these are unconditional parts of being in a committed relationship when a partner is ill. So in general, caregiving can provide the couple with opportunities to strengthen and deepen an already established commitment. It can give opportunity to provide as well as receive great love, gratitude, and resolution. or it can infuse the relationship with conflict and emotional pain, leaving couples feeling isolated, stuck, and spinning in confusion. So the question is, how do you have a healthy conversation about cancer and its stresses when you are not feeling healthy as a person with cancer, you're not feeling healthy as the caregiver? Most people don't know how to be a caregiver for a loved one with metastatic disease, and therefore it is a learning curve. Please remember that. It is a learning curve. But some of the common concerns that cancer care oncology social workers hear from caregivers is their fear of the unknown, concerns for the present and the future, unexpected and unwanted changes in life balance and direction, and an ongoing emotional roller coaster, which we don't know which direction the roller coaster is going, as well as concrete and financial considerations. And with prostate cancer, especially metastatic prostate cancer, there are even more complex layers of reactions and responses. Prostate cancer is, as I've mentioned before in other talks, comparatively to other diagnoses, the primary male-identified cancer, where the emotional and psychological factors of the illness and treatment side effects are justifiably as decisively important as are the clinical factors, if not more. And unlike most other cancers, prostate cancer speaks to the heart and soul of male identity and self-worth. Father, husband, partner, spouse, soulmate, grandfather, uncle, brother, son, income earners, head of the household, head of the family, pillar of strength. We've all heard, wait till your father comes home. Your father and I will discuss this and we'll let you know. We have all heard variations of these male labels and statements associated with being a man and fatherhood. And it becomes a rude awakening for all of us to realize how vulnerable we all really are, and which can be particularly difficult for a man to admit and acknowledge and address. A prostate cancer diagnosis can derail a man's self-image and leave a man to ask, well, who am I then if I have trouble being the husband or father I was before my prostate cancer? Changes in sexual virility, low or loss of libido, fatigue, erectile dysfunction, impotence, incontinence, all, whether temporary or permanent, are components to be carefully and clearly reviewed by the medical team, your oncologist, and necessitate ongoing exploration with the patient and affected loved ones. These variable reactions of treatment side effects places a man and his partner immediately in the midst of quality of life issues, rendering the potential for in-depth and heartfelt discussions focused on the makeup of the relationship, especially intimacy, love, identity, and roles they have within the family as the father, as the mother, etc. Both the man with metastatic cancer and the caregiver share similar emotional reactions, just at different scales, such as a sense of grief, confusion, fear, anxiety, sadness, shame. And for some, though hard to admit, for some caregivers, resentment and anger. The balance of these feelings within the context of ongoing treatment become the crucial and central theme of the discussion for the man with cancer and with a loved one. There will be an impact on the relationship and a change in the quality of life for the caregiver. However, the toll can be mitigated to a degree with the support for the patient and with the support for the caregiver. This means a focus on substantive, honest communication with each other. All the literature continues to talk about ongoing communication. But how does a couple get to that point of communication? A man's sense of self is challenged to communicate and share his concerns with his partner. A caregiver feels guilty at being overwhelmed, tired, angry. Both need support to do this. Others need to learn to do this. And other couples have communication skills already established in their relationships prior to the cancer diagnosis and may be more adept at getting to those conversations. The hopeful goal will be that the partners will explore and find other mutually satisfying expressions in learning to cope with metastatic cancer and the choices and decisions that are often a part of the self-care of the relationship. So it's not only about what do I need, what does my husband need, but what does the relationship need? Again, for the caregiver, common statements are admitting admitting that they are stressed, anxious, they have mood swings, there's loss of energy, getting too much or too little sleep, depression, loss of interest in normal enjoyable activities, hypervigilance about the loved one with cancer, sadness, feeling overwhelmed, feeling alone, tired, lonely, and with physical manifestations such as headaches, body pain, digestive issues. These often accompany the role as a caregiver. Remember, as a caregiver, you are grieving what the person with cancer is going through. You are grieving what you are going through and what you as a couple are going through. And as with any cancer diagnosis, life is altered. Identity and definition of life, of your role, are now permanently shifted for the person with cancer, the caregiver, and the family. And as I stated before, being a caregiver to a man with prostate cancer may experience similar levels and amounts of stress, although the nature of that stress may be different than those felt by the patient. Again, essential to learning to cope and live with cancer for the patient and the caregiver is communication. Couples face necessary tasks of examining their individual reactions to the diagnosis and treatments, and intentionally then create opportunities to share those reactions with each other, again, and may involve heartfelt and difficult conversations about advanced directives, living wills, healthcare proxy designation, palliative care choices, and other significant decisions. Caregivers need support. I call that secondary caregiving. Whether you're a local caregiver or a long-distance caregiver, which has its own specific stressors, support is essential and often consists of both informal and formal support. If you are the person with cancer, you may want to suggest to your caregiver to seek out support. When the caregiver is stressed, the caregiving is strained and the relationship is taxed. Find out about your caregiving resources. Inform your doctor, your therapist. Find a therapist so they can monitor both your physical health and your emotional well-being as a caregiver. Learn about external support systems. There are many out there. Learn about individual or couples counseling, caregiving group counseling, caregiving peer support organizations. These outlets can provide the caregiver with information to improve coping strategies, as well as to provide communication skills and tools that are all necessary to build a framework that is about learning to live life as a caregiver. Ask for and accept help. Don't feel guilty about not being the perfect caregiver. There is no such thing. No one took a course in caregiving until life puts them in that position. Set realistic goals, prioritize stressors and tasks into smaller stressors and tasks, and delegate. Identify what you can change in your caregiving and what you cannot change in your caregiving. Stay in touch with supportive family and friends. Schedule breaks and fun, however brief or small. Eat, take care of your health, try to get sufficient sleep. For some, this may come more naturally. Others, this is a challenge. Cancer care's oncology social workers are experts in supporting anyone affected by cancer, the person with cancer and the caregiver. Cancer care's counseling services, in person, on the phone, or online, can provide the emotional support couples may need to begin their courageous journey of living with metastatic prostate cancer. Other resources to always consider are your oncologist and the oncology team, the Prostate Cancer Foundation, US2, TOO, which is an organization founded by men with prostate cancer for men with prostate cancer. Immerman Angels, that's I-M-E-R-M-A-N, Immerman Angels, is an organization that will seek out and provide peer support. So for caregivers contacting Immerman Angels, you will find someone else who is in or as close to the exact circumstances and demographic that you are in. The American Cancer Society, the National Alliance for Caregiving, the National Family Caregivers Alliance, Don't Lose Heart, Caregivers Caring for Caregivers. And finally, I'll close with that any questions, any concerns or issues that you have as a caregiver or as a person with cancer, please call our Cancer Care Oncology social workers who are available 9 to 6:30 Monday through Friday and 9 to 4:30 on Friday. 9 to 6:30 Monday through Thursday, and Fridays 9 to 4:30, and that's Eastern Standard Time. And so with that, I'll close and give it back to Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Gordon, for just an exceptional presentation on caregiving and really on all the issues that people are experiencing. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. It's just exquisite. Thank you very much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Cubbert, and Dr. Cubbert is an anesthesiologist with the Pain Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Cubbert is going to address managing symptoms, side effects, and pain, quality of life concerns, and communicating with the healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Cubbert.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Unrelieved pain can lead to a poor quality of life and an inability to complete treatment. And it's very important that pain be treated aggressively for these reasons. Pain can be caused by the disease itself, the treatments of cancer, or surgery. The most important part of treating any pain is to identify its source. And then there are various modalities that can be used. Pain itself can be classified into somatic pain, visceral pain, or neuropathic pain. There are different types of pain, and somatic pain is usually well localized. It's constant. Usually the characteristics are aching and throbbing. It's the result of activation of receptors in the skin, the muscle, and the bone. So a good example of somatic pain would be if there's a lesion in the vertebral body of the spine, the pain could be felt at the area involvement localized to the back. Visceral pain could be a little tricky. It's pain due to any kind of lesion in the abdomen or the pelvis. It's deep, it's dull, it's aching, and it has a very vague location. Sometimes in chronic visceral pain, it can produce referred pain. An example of this might be a lesion in the liver, which would produce maybe shoulder pain if the liver capsule was distended. Neuropathic pain is even trickier than all the other two. It's when a lesion affects a nerve, and this pain is most difficult for patients to understand as well as physicians because it's a pain that's not what most people are used to feeling. When nerves are involved, the pain can be described as lancinating, burning, shooting, numbing. Even when something's numb, you can still have pain. Sometimes it's even difficult to touch the area affected, and sometimes when something's painful, it causes even more pain than it would usually. So an example of this would be shingles. After the rash is completely gone, all the wounds are healed, sometimes the pain remains. And it's called postherpetic neuralgia. And this is a great example of neuropathic pain. People have the lesions in their thoracic area, sometimes have difficulty wearing a shirt. They describe it as burning, lancinating, and shooting-type pains. And it could be quite distressing. Another example of neuropathic pain might be if there's a lesion in a rib. And under the rib is a nerve called the intercostal nerve. When the lesion touches this nerve, the pain can wrap all the way around the torso. Neuropathy can also occur after a chemotherapy, leading to nerve pain in the feet and the hands. If the pain is constant, I really feel that the pain must be treated in a way that involves around-the-clock dosing of some kind of medicine. The dosing schedule really should be contingent on time rather than symptoms, and this approach allows the patient to treat the pain rather than try to play catch-up. The hardest thing to do with pain and constipation is to play catch up. So you don't really want to get behind in any kind of pain regimen that you're put on. But at times, despite the establishment of an effective preventive schedule, breakthrough pain or pain on top of the normal pain still occurs, whether it's from an activity or just on its own. It's a common occurrence in cancer pain, and then you need to supplement an established schedule to take care of that pain. So I just wanted to talk about medications for a minute, and the first one I wanted to talk about was just basically NSAIDs. Now, NSAIDs, some of them are sold over-the-counter. There's Aleve, which is basically naproxen, ibuprofen, Motrin, and there are prescription NSAIDs as well. Bone pain from lesions are actually caused by the release of chemicals that are blocked with NSAIDs, so it's a very good adjunct to other medicines. The problem with NSAIDs are that there are side effects, and they can cause GI bleeding, GI distress, and in long-term use, damage to the kidneys as well. As far as your GI system, it's really important if you are taking some sort of an NSAID to supplement with some kind of protectant, either a Pepcid, Prilosec, or Prevacid. And it's always important to stay hydrated as well. They also tend to interfere with the function of platelets, and platelets are cells in the blood that are responsible for you allowing to clot. So if you're going for a surgical procedure, the surgeon's going to want you to be off an NSAID for at least a week. Chemotherapy can also lower your platelet counts. So if you're taking a drug that interferes with your platelet function and your counts are low to begin with, it might be inappropriate. A lot of our cancer patients are also on blood thinners for various reasons, whether it be blood clots or whether it be drugs like Plavix for heart disease, and taking NSAIDs are contraindicated due to the risk of bleeding. Although NSAIDs, many of them are sold over the counter, you have to really be careful because they can cause more damage than you might expect. The next class of drugs that we use the most are the opioids. And once a decision has been made to use an opioid, the next decision really is the selection of an appropriate drug. There's a lot of ways to classify opioids, and for a long time we've been classifying them as weak and strong. And it's kind of a misleading because a strong opioid can turn into a weak opioid if you use a very small dose, and a weak opioid can turn into a strong dose. So a strong opioid if you use a very large dose. But we usually classify the weaker opioids because they're usually in combination with Tylenol. Codeine, oxycodone, and hydrocodone are considered the weaker opioids. And paired with Tylenol, oxycodone and Tylenol are Percocet, hydrocodone and Tylenol are Vicodin, and Tylenol with codeine is Tylenol number 3. Out of these three drugs, only oxycodone and codeine can be given without the Tylenol. And it's real important to remember that excess Tylenol is not good either. It can easily affect the liver if taken in doses that are too much. And it really should be given in less than, conservatively, 2 grams a day. So another thing to keep in mind is just because Tylenol, a simple thing as Tylenol is over the counter, doesn't necessarily mean it's harmless. So the first narcotic we can talk about is oxycodone. And you can remember that oxycodone comes in various forms. There are immediate-release pills for so-called breakthrough pain, and it comes in an elixir as well if it's difficult to take the pills. And these two drugs are good for immediate release, and they're good for breakthrough pain. But there's also a longer-acting form of oxycodone, and that's OxyContin. Whenever you hear the word content at the end of a medication, it means continuous, and that means it's time release. And the time release seems to work better because it gives a steady level of the medication. So you take the OxyContin 2 times a day, and it gives a constant level in the bloodstream, again, for around-the-clock dosing. There's a new derivative of oxycodone called Opana, which also comes in an immediate-release tablet, and as well as an extended release in a long-acting form. The next drug is morphine. And when people hear morphine, they right away think that's the last drug that we can possibly use. But in actuality, morphine is weaker than oxycodone in equivalent dosages. A long time ago, researchers at Memorial established equivalent doses for these opioids, and they compared the different ones and how strong they are compared to 10 milligrams of morphine. And oxycodone is actually stronger than morphine. But to reiterate, morphine also comes in an immediate-release pill as well as a liquid. And there are also long-acting forms of morphine as well. MS-Contin, again, the continuous release. Cadian, which can be opened up and sprinkled on applesauce if it's difficult to swallow. And Avinza, which is a once-a-day drug. So there are long-acting opioids for around-the-clock dosing, keeping a blood level, and they should be always taken on a schedule. Fentanyl is also a very popular drug, and it comes in a patch. A lot of people prefer wearing the patch rather than taking pills. You change the patch every 3 days, although some people need to change the patches every 2 days, about 25% of people. You place the patch on somewhere flat, your chest, your back, your arm, and then 3 days later you change it. It gives you a constant level of the drug. You just got to be careful about exposing yourself to extreme heat, like going in a sauna or a whirlpool, because it can accelerate absorption. Fentanyl is another drug that comes in an immediate release form. The two that were used the most are Actiq and Fentora, and you basically rub it in the mucosa of the mouth. Because it's absorbed so quickly through the mucosa of the mouth, it's almost like getting IV fentanyl. And these drugs are good for if you have pain that's incident, like pain with a bowel movement, pain right after you eat, or pain just to get onto the radiation table. And we'll sometimes give people as a breakthrough these medications to get them through radiation treatment as well. They're good drugs because they act extremely quickly, but they only last about an hour. The next drug is Dilaudid. Again, it could be immediate release or in a liquid, and it comes in a new long-acting form called Exalgo, which is relatively new. The last drug I wanted to talk about was methadone. When people think of methadone, you usually associate this drug with people detoxing from drugs. They give this drug for detox because it has a very long half-life. In actuality, we use it for cancer pain, and it's probably our most effective drug. It has slightly different properties than all the other opioids, and that way can be more effective in helping nerve pain than the other opioids. But because of its long half-life, the physicians always need to start low and gradually titrate up the dose. So in reality, methadone, which is given 3 times a day, is probably our best drug for treating cancer pain as well as neuropathic pain. So the question becomes, which long-acting opioid, which short-acting opioid should be used? And the answer really is depends. It depends. There are people who get better analgesia from one opioid than another. There are also people who have side effects from one opioid and not another. So you really need to work and find the right combination. And sometimes it could be trial and error. With that said, the opioids do have side effects, sedation, mental clouding, nausea, vomiting, itching, and, of course, constipation. Patients can become tolerant to all these side effects except constipation. That never goes away. If you're having side effects from opioid, the side effects can be treated or the opioid needs to be changed. But constipation needs to be dealt with prophylactically whenever an opioid regimen is started. So if you're going to start an opioid regimen, a bowel regimen should also be started. People always ask, am I going to get addicted to these narcotics? And the answer is sort of. You get physically dependent to them, which basically means that if you're taking these opioids for greater than a few weeks, you can't stop them abruptly because you will get symptoms of withdrawal. So if you're taking the opioids for a period of time and you don't need them anymore, what you need to do is have a weaning schedule to wean yourself off the opioids. But that's really different than psychological dependence. Psychological dependence is really how we define addiction. And it's really aberrant behavior and using it for non-medical purposes. And the incidence in cancer patients is extremely, extremely low. There's always a risk, but fortunately, it's extremely low. Another common question and response is, I don't want to take these drugs now because they won't work later if I need them. This is something called tolerance. Tolerance is when you need an increased amount of the drug to get a desired given effect. And what we've been finding is that tolerance does occur, but not as often as we thought. So how we deal with intolerance is sometimes by increasing the dose, or by changing the medication and rotating the narcotics, or adding methadone, which tends to decrease the tolerance to opioids as well. There are some other common drugs that we use specifically for nerve pain, and a lot of them are advertised on TV. Neurontin for a long time has been a mainstay of treatment, and they come up with Lyrica, which is pretty much the new Neurontin. These drugs originally were anticonvulsants or anti-seizure medications. However, no one really uses them for that purpose. Lyrica you see all the time advertised on TV for something called fibromyalgia, which is muscle pain, but it's a really good drug and was originally made for people with neuropathic pain and for shingles. There are some side effects. You can get some weight gain, some edema of the feet, which does get better if you stop it, some dizziness and lightheadedness. Of course, all the side effects listed on TV make it sound slightly worse than it really is. There are some people who've had some mood changes, but for the most part, people do tolerate it. You have to take these medicines on a daily basis and on a schedule, and you have to really titrate them slowly. The slower you titrate them, the easier it is to tolerate them. You tend to get used to them, and they can be very good additions to the opioids as well, or the NSAIDs, and they're called adjuvant drugs, and we use them for neuropathic pain all the time. Another class of drugs that we use for neuropathic pain or nerve pain is the antidepressants. We used to use Elavil and Pamelor, which are tricyclic antidepressants, more frequently than we do now. They do have more side effects, including dry mouth, constipation, and some heart difficulties as well. You've probably seen Cymbalta on the market, and it's on the market more for muscle pain, and it's on TV all the time. We've been using this drug for neuropathic pain as well. We actually find it's the best drug that we have for chemo-induced neuropathy. It does have side effects, nausea, vomiting, sometimes mood change, hopefully for the better, sometimes for the worse, because it's an antidepressant. Some people do feel a little lousy when they stop it for a couple of weeks afterwards. There are also topical creams, which we compound for neuropathic pain, especially in sensitive areas. There's a lidoderm patch, which is a topical patch, which really has no side effects, which was made for shingles as well. All these drugs can be used for neuropathic pain, which can be sometimes difficult to treat. With that said, there's a lot of medications to try and to try to come up with a combination that will treat the pain. At times, these options aren't either good enough or causing too many side effects, and we'll then turn to a delivery system that's different than taking it or taking the medications either orally or through the intravenous. And what that is called an intrathecal pump. This pump goes into the spinal system, spinal area, and it's implanted underneath the skin in the abdomen. The medication then travels through a catheter into the spinal area. There's a lot of advantages for giving the medications this way. You can use different opioids in this pump. There's local anesthetic that we use in the pump that numbs the pain, but does not necessarily numb the person. And we use a drug called clonidine, which is a hypertensive medication, but it's been found very effective in neuropathic pain. The opioids given spinally act on different receptors, and the numbing drugs can be used to numb specific areas. So the advantages of this system is that there's less opioid, less side effects. If I had to give a patient 100 milligrams of IV morphine, I might only have to give them 1 milligram of intrathecal morphine to get an equivalent dosage. But the disadvantage is there's something implanted inside. And most people don't feel that it's an inconvenience. However, it is a bulky pump. There's a very low risk of infection, and knock on wood, we've only had one infection in the 11 years I've been back at Sloan Kettering. So every 6-day weeks, you come in for a refill as an outpatient, and there's a machine that almost looks like a remote control for a TV set that you can put over the pump and give yourself a bolus if you need it. Another modality that we sometimes use for pain at Memorials are nerve blocks. If one or two specific nerves can be identified for causing the pain, we'll make sure by first anesthetizing that nerve with local anesthesia and identifying that specific nerve. If that nerve can then be put out of action, we do it with various modalities, including chemical neurolysis like alcohol, radio frequency, which is basically a heat probe, or cryoablation, which is a freezing probe. But side effects include numbness in the area, and we always have to make sure we're not destroying a nerve that is used for motor purposes. So in summary, there are multiple alternatives to control pain. You need to try different options. You need to do it in a stepwise and logical fashion. And you need to tailor the best option to each individual patient and their caregiver. And with that said, I'll turn it over to back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Covert. Very comprehensive presentation on really the management of discomfort and pain. We thank you, and I think people got a lot of information. And now we do have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and if Stephanie will explain to you how to queue up for questions. And also, if you don't get to ask your question today or you think of some questions next week, please call us at 1-800-813-HOPE. And I'll repeat that number again toward the end of the program. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone to ask a question.
So I have a question for one of our online participants. Is there a foolproof way to remember to give my loved one the right medicines at the right time? Dr. Covert, do you want to address that?
Yeah, there's no foolproof way. I think the best way to do it is to kind of dole out the medicine for the day. There's usually, medication where you can put it in the different compartments of a medication box, which will have the day of the week on it as well. And sort of just do it every single day, just dole out the pills and the times. And a lot of people keep records. Now of how many times they take their breakthrough. They'll use their iPad to do it as well, and it sometimes helps us as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And there's another question, and I think for Bill, Mr. Gordon. How do I find out about caregiving resources in my community?
Well, one is you can call Cancer Care. I mean, Cancer Care is a national organization, although we're located in the New York City tri-state area, and we do have resources from all around the country. I would also say that oftentimes a Google search of caregiving resources. Sometimes you can even put in cancer caregiving resources and put in the community that you are in. Certainly in talking to your social worker, your nurse, your oncologist. And also that caregiving can happen in different forms, as I mentioned before. They can be in person, they can be on the phone, and there's a lot of caregiving resources online. There are online groups, there are online chat rooms, and people find these especially helpful because they can go to these chat rooms or these online groups any time of the day or night. So in the middle of the night, they can type in these questions. Now, again, these are not live chat rooms or online groups, but people always respond within a few hours. So again, it is really, another thing is if there's a local mental health service and sometimes even charitable organizations. So there are resources out there. They may not be local resources, face-to-face local resources, but there is help out there. There is help available.
Perfect. Excellent. And so that's really good for everyone to know. And then there is a question also for Dr. Slovin about really what is kind of new on the horizon, or what are some of the newer treatments that people should be aware of? And I know you've discussed them in part, but they're kind of asking for a little bit more detail or a little bit more just general information about what to look for in the future.
Okay. Well, personalized medicine, as I alluded to earlier, is becoming very, very important. Many doctors now have the opportunity to take either tissue samples or blood samples and send it to, for example, the Broad Institute at MIT and come back with a published list of genetic alterations or mutations. As I said, while this is very informative and perhaps could be used for therapies that are directed against the mutation, the problem is that prostate cancer is very smart. It puts out little collaterals and tries to avoid that area where it knows that you're directing your therapy. So single-agent therapies may not just be sufficient for the cancer. That being said, we are really getting more and more information trying to know, excuse me, which mutations are, the ones that we may be needing. There is constantly a barrage of new drugs that are on the horizon with very unique combinations. We're moving more and more of the established treatments even earlier in the treatment armamentarium, you know, before the patient even becomes resistant. And as a result, we're really hoping to understand better how resistance occurs and how we can circumvent it much earlier than we had previously expected to do so.
Thank you. Excellent. Thank you so much. And another question from Mr. Gorin. Money worries are weighing us down. How can I deal with this while stressed about everything else? So if you could comment on just resources for money, for assistance with financial.
Yes. I mean, this is an ubiquitous problem for any type of cancer. Resources, financial economic resources out there are limited, but there are, for prostate cancer, there are some resources available. Some of the copay foundations, like the Patient Advocate Foundation, and other copay organizations. So again, I would, you could call Cancer Care, talk to a social worker, you can Google copay assistance for prostate cancer, and you will get some hits. Sometimes we just suggest going to the United Way, Salvation Army, charitable organizations, talking to a social worker about referrals to the financial department at the hospital to discuss payment plans. It is one of the most difficult and complex issues when coping, learning to cope and live with cancer. We address these problems on a daily basis with the multiple calls that we get from all over the country. They are complex, and it really means developing a strategy in terms of the finances that are impacted by a cancer diagnosis. So again, it is, and this is where reaching out to other peers is really important, like Immerman Angels, and finding out how other families, other caregivers have coped with these. Because sometimes, I mean, it's great, it's important, it's necessary to talk to a professional, but sometimes there's nothing like talking to another person who's going through what you're going through or has been through what you've been through to find out how they got through it or how they are getting through it. So, reach out to your peers, reach out to peer support organizations, and reach out to your mental health and other social workers, psychologists for any types of referrals that will support your living with cancer.
And Bill, there's one last question I want to take to be sure before we end this program. It's on, do you have any advice on parenting young children while caring for my partner with cancer? Now, this is a big issue for people, both own children or grandchildren. I wonder if you could just comment on that briefly. And
That's such a tender and such an important and tender issue. And again, I know I'm sounding repetitious, but calling. Cancer Care is, we do have a number of resources that are readily available. There are additional resources on childhood trauma from the National Child Trauma Stress Network. Again, Googling support for children where cancer is in the family, you will get hits. We here at Cancer Care, we do provide services for children that are affected by cancer. There are numerous publications, books for parents to help children come understand what's happening to a parent. There is a very wonderful book by Kathleen McHugh, that's McCue, called How to Help Children Through a Parent's Serious Illness. I'll repeat that. Kathleen McHugh, How to Help Children Through a Parent's Serious Illness. We actually use this book here as Cancer Care as sort of our textbook in working with children who are affected by cancer. I would highly, highly recommend that book. And through that book, you will also come and be able to find other resources, organizations that can provide more support. And again, I go back to talking to your peers and talking to other parents and finding out how they strategically help their children.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been extraordinary. And I want to thank actually all of our participants who've queued up and really provided us online questions today, particularly. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. I do remind you that this is a one-hour program, and that in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs, as evidenced by your questions that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And we've provided you various resources and materials, but we also want to encourage you to actually, you also can call Cancer Care. Our services are free at 1-800-813-HOPE. And our large staff of oncology social workers are here to help you and help you to kind of find the best services for you. Most importantly, as we conclude the program today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with metastatic prostate cancer or in coping with cancer in general. I want you to know that you're now part of the Cancer Care community, and we're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE, or you may visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone, have a wonderful day.